Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, June 6th, 2024. I'm Anthony Pastore here in our broadcast studio in New York City. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, I am going to be joined for this conversation by my Chief Investment Office colleagues, Leslie Falconio and David Lefkowitz. And as always, for this particular call or the show, we always appreciate hearing from you, our live audience. So when the time is right, please click that Ask a Question button right on your screen. And we'll get the question here in the room, and we will then open up the lines to discussion of those questions a little bit later with Leslie and David. All right, so let's dive right in. Leslie, I want to start with you. Welcome, first of all. Something that I know all of our viewers are consistently looking out for are interest rates. They've been volatile, to say the least, since the start of the year. Here we go. What's your outlook for rates as we get into the back half? And given that we have expectations for what the Fed may or may not do for the rest of this year, how does it play into what you're talking about as far as opportunities for investors?
Yeah, I mean, listen, one of the things this year is that we've had a constant reassessing and repricing of the Fed path. And what we know is that the fixed income market is forward-looking, but the Fed is backward-looking. And when the Fed sort of dictates everything to data dependence, the market overreacts to every data number. And you're going to have these bouts because the fixed income market's forward-looking where you see, you know, the Fed and the market's expectation not converge, right? So when it does start to converge is when you have a lot of volatility, but then finally it stabilizes, and that's really where we are right now. With that said, you know, we have payrolls tomorrow. And just for an example, you know, the consensus number on payrolls is 185, but the range is 120 to 250. So a lot of this economic data has caused a lot of volatility. And what will happen is that the market, the fixed income market, because it is forward-looking, will really start to, has a potential to diverge of what the Fed is dictating. So when we think about what we look at on for the June 12th meeting, we have two things. We have CPI that morning, which is obviously going to be very important in the sense that the market's going to want to see whether or not, you know, the recent weakness is a trend or just a blip. And then we have the Fed on the same day, which is obviously going to have a new summary of economic projections. The positive to this is that since the repricing in April, we've had the market project a Fed funds rate that has a cut of between one and two cuts, right? Now it's leaning more towards two, after we had a little bit of weaker in the JOLTS data. So it's leaning more towards two cuts right now. But it's not that really far off of what we think the Fed will normally guide with the summary of economic projections, which is probably move from 75 basis points to 50 basis points of cuts this year. But the difference is that what the market has done is that we talk about this terminal rate. And we talk about like what the market is pricing in 2024, but what does it think about going forward? And again, the fixed income market is forward looking. You know, the terminal rate now that the market is expecting is about a 368. And that's the lowest that we've seen since, say, April 1st, before all this correction started. So obviously, the market doesn't believe that a neutral rate is 2.5 like the Fed does. But a 368, it's really come around. And the reason why that is that while the stability that we've seen of one to two cuts kind of back and forth for the past month and a half, that 2025, the cuts have moved greater. So now we're down to about 90 basis points of cuts, which we didn't see in April. I mean, a lot of this, obviously, they're still going to be data dependent. Our expectation is they're still going to have more of a wait and see type stance, unless we have a very, you know, a below consensus number on tomorrow's non-farm payroll. But more than likely, at least we're now more aligned. And I think it's important to note that as well, is that, you know, we have almost a Fed that's been on hold for almost a year. I mean, it was last July that it was the peak rate. We've kind of stayed there for a long period of time. So our expectation is going forward, particularly with the rate call, is that, you know, we do believe that softness in data will force yields down more than strengthening data will force yields up, assuming that, you know, the hiking scenario doesn't come back into the marketplace.
Right. And Leslie, before I go on to David, and this might be a good segue for what David's going to talk about with us, is, you know, when you look at the 10-year Treasury, the last week or so, it's fallen about, you know, 20, almost 50 basis points or so. I mean, it's really had a big drop. Right now, it's trading at about a 4.3%, 4.29. What's behind that?
Well, I think, you know, part of that is, you know, first off, the JOLTS data, the job openings data, you know, is falling, right? So when job openings are falling like that, it's the expectation that wages will follow, right? But there's a difference between, like, having job openings contract versus job losses, right? Because that would be more of the hard landing scenario. And what I was mentioning earlier is that because the fixed income market really follows that Fed path, when you have some of this weaker data, they put in more cuts, and the 10-year is going to follow that forward path that the fixed income market's expecting for the Fed fund rate. So that's why we've come down so much, simply on sulfur data and the expectation that maybe not this year. They go, we have two expectations this year. This is what the market is expecting as well in terms of cuts. But in 2025, they're pricing in more cuts, so that 10-year is coming down.
Excellent. Thank you, Leslie. So, David, let's pivot now to the equity side of the market. We've seen real growth in S&P 500 this week and continuing to hit or, beat all-time highs almost on a daily basis since the earlier part of this week. You and your team have now increased your year-end target on the S&P 500. What was the real conviction behind that? What was the catalyst behind there? And where are the opportunities given what you've looked at in the market? And where are you expecting investors to kind of get the best bang for their buck these days?
Sure. Happy to tackle all those questions. We did raise our year-end price target on the S&P 500. We're now at 5,500 for the end of this year, which, frankly, is not that much higher than where we currently are. As you point out, we've made a string of new highs throughout the year, and most recently yesterday. The catalyst for raising the price target was really the earnings season, which was quite good. Mm. It's not always homogeneous. There are going to be, there's diversity in terms of how companies perform in terms of earnings. But I would say overall, lots of companies and the vast majority of companies produce really good results. And importantly, the guidance for the second quarter is indicating that this momentum is continuing into the second quarter. So that gave us the confidence to raise our full-year earnings estimates. We're now looking for 11% earnings growth this year, 6% for next year, and that was really the catalyst for raising the price target. But I wouldn't focus so much on these price targets specifically. I would rather focus on the environment, mm-hmm. right? And what I would say, it's a constructive environment for equities. And there's really kind of three elements here. First, we've had very durable economic growth, certainly much better than anyone was thinking 18 months ago when everyone was thinking about a recession and the risks around that. And we think that growth will continue. It's also leading to a broadening out and an improvement in profit growth. And that's clearly the story for this year. And I think we've got a chart on the screen showing earnings expectations are hitting all-time highs, right? So it's not surprising that the stock market itself is hitting all-time highs when we've seen continued new highs in earnings estimates. Mm. The other thing going on is inflation. And Leslie talked a little bit about this, but big picture, inflation peaked in the middle of 22 at 9%. Now it's somewhere around 3-ish. And we think it's probably headed a bit lower, closer to the Fed's target. So what that means is that, first of all, that dynamic where you have solid growth and improving inflation, that's a very equity-friendly environment. And it also means that the Fed is likely to start cutting interest rates later this year. And again, just reemphasizing sort of this favorable environment. And I would say the third element is artificial intelligence. I mean, clearly, just an incredible surge of investment in artificial intelligence infrastructure and the buildup of applications to take advantage of these technologies. Obviously, that's had a big impact on the markets as mm-hmm. well. If I had to sum it up, I think all these trends are still largely in place, with the caveat that a lot of the good news, I think, is fully reflected. So our main message is stay invested, stay the course. If we get some pullbacks, that might be a better time to deploy capital, but it's a good environment. In terms of where we see opportunities right now, from a sector perspective, we do like tech. It's been obviously a good performer, but we think it makes sense to stick with it. And markets are recovering. The AI story that we talked about, very high quality companies, returning cash to shareholders, et cetera. Industrials is also an area that we think is interesting. There's a lot of different things going on in lots of different components of industrials, but generally improving global manufacturing should be good for industrials. We do like small caps. I would caveat, look, they're very cheap, and I think the long-term outlook there is still quite good. But we have been disappointed that we haven't seen a better earnings performance from small caps. We think it will get better, but I think that's part of the reason why they've been lagging this year. And we're expecting that to see a catch up there on earnings, but we haven't yet seen that. And then thematically, there's a number of areas that I think are interesting. We talked about AI. We also think having some irons in the fire on a housing recovery. On the infrastructure spending that's going around out throughout the United States, on reshoring, on just quality companies in general. So we have a number of themes that we like. Sometimes it's best to look at those types of opportunities because sometimes sectors, are not necessarily the most elegant way of expressing a viewpoint.
Great, David, thank you. Leslie, let me come back to you. And maybe I'll get a little bit more specific with you, looking at mortgage-backed securities and collateralized MBS. I know that they're two of your, preferred sectors right now. What's the outlook for mortgages in the months ahead? I mean, clearly, we see 30-year fixed mortgage rates still in that 7.5% range. They haven't come down all that much. How does that affect the MBS market?
Well, actually, believe it or not, that's been actually a positive to MBS because it's lowered the supply, right? Given the consumer is pretty much, 60 to 70% of the consumers locked in at 4% or less, you haven't had a lot of people go out in terms of locking that 7.5, 7.8. So the supply to the marketplace and agency MBS has been much lower. However, as a sector, it has a very high correlation to interest rates and interest rate volatility, which, as we discussed earlier, with all this recessing and repricing of what the Fed's going to do, it's been fairly high. So the sector in and of itself, although has done very well since the May 1st FOMC, when the probability of a rate hike was taken off the table, it's still, in terms of the sector, very cheap. It's probably about one standard deviation cheap to its history. When you have an asset class that has about where a current coupon is 140 spread, a 570 yield, for a AAA sector with an incredible amount of liquidity, given where we are in the cycle, we just think this is, it's been a good asset class, and we think it'll be better going forward. But what we need to see is volatility come down, which we do think is going to happen once, the Fed starts to cut. But obviously, the risk to the agency MBS side is if we have a reflation or they price in a hike again, that's going to be a very difficult for the sector. But overall, it's not only cheap within itself, but it's also very cheap when you compare it to other higher quality sectors, right? For a AAA high quality 570, it's done well, but we think it could do a lot better. On the CMBS side, look, as we know, after SVB in March, the market was pricing in, dire straits for not just CRE, but the amount of potential recession, the amount of defaults, delinquencies in the sector, and it offered investors actually a lot of cushion because, remember, it's not just a delinquency or default. It's whether or not that delinquency or default comes in higher than what the market's pricing in. And because the market was pricing in such negativity in 2023 and because CMBS underperformed, it really gave investors quite a cushion heading into the new year. Now, because we entered the year with not thinking there would be a recession, right? The asset class has actually proven to do quite well. For example, AAA CMBS are up 2%, BBB CMBS are up over 12% this year. But here's the thing, when we look at it, how it's done today versus the same as other risk sectors, that cushion that we had in 23 is starting to compress, right? As spreads are compressed, that protection that you have is not as great. So our allocation remains with the preferred allocation within the higher quality. We're looking at it, we're monitoring it, we think it'll still do well, but just know that the cushion that you once had, you don't have it right now simply because the sector's done so well.
Leslie, thank you very much. Before we continue on, just to remind our audience, if you'd like to ask a question, click that Ask a Question button on your screen, and then we'll get the questions here for Leslie and David in the room. So make sure you're doing that. We'll get to those in just a couple minutes. David, you talked about AI. It's hard. You can't really talk about equities in general without mentioning AI, but kind of digging in more specifically, tech stocks have certainly, as you just discussed, seen a real benefit from all this AI kind of news and the excitement around it. What other areas of the market that may be tied or, sort of on the sidelines of AI that maybe might be poised to do well here that you're talking about?
Sure. So I'll get to the non-tech beneficiaries, but I think it's also important to recognize that whenever we see these big technological changes, platform shifts, whatever you want to call it, look, the long-term winners are going to be the ones that are the companies that are driving the innovation. And that's clearly in the tech space. And now we can talk about, you know, have expectations got a little bit too high or, you know, things like that. But we, you know, we do think there's a real opportunity to see productivity enhancements from artificial intelligence. And it's going to be those companies that are really developing those innovative technologies that are going to accrue the biggest benefits, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's important to at least keep that in perspective. That being said, yes, we do think there are areas outside of tech where there are some opportunities, primarily because we're seeing so much spending going on. I mean, the companies that are deploying capital have huge deep pockets, right? I mean, it's all the big tech companies, it's governments that are doing this around the world. So we're seeing such a surge in investment that there are parts of the sort of infrastructure build out for AI where we're just seeing shortages, mm. right? So, you know, right now, you know, it's hard to get transformers for data centers. It's hard to get data center space. It's hard to get power to data centers. We need a lot of heating, ventilation, air conditioning for, you know, we need to cool the data center. So there are specific pockets where I would say there are some bottlenecks. And those can be good tactical opportunities. And we have a list of AI stocks that we think are beneficiaries. So we have a mixture, I would say, of, you know, well-known tech names on the infrastructure side, on the application side, and a lot of these are software companies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't yet seen the application ecosystem is really in its infancy, and it's not clear who the winners are going to be. So, you know, having a diversified basket in that area makes sense. And then I would also say, you know, where we think the bottlenecks currently are, this mismatch between supply and demand, where you're seeing certain companies get rewarded for that.
And you were talking earlier about 11% earnings growth this year, 6% next year. AI and tech, mm-hmm. How percentage-wise, they're probably a large chunk of that. And of course, as you were saying, the companies that might even benefit from this tech boom.
Yes. So if you look at the way we've looked at this is sort of Magnificent Seven.
Right.
You know, people probably know what those are. These are the large tech companies, large growth companies. How are they doing? How are their earnings doing relative to the rest of the market? And, you know, so far, the last year, basically all the earnings growth in the S&P 500 has been from the Mag 7.
Right.
Now, we think that's about to shift, where we're going to see a broadening out of earnings growth. That's certainly our expectation as we go into the second quarter reporting season and the second half. But yeah, they've been an outsized contributor to the earnings story.
Great. Thanks, David. Leslie, just bringing you back in, certainly you and I have talked about this a number of times on various other programs that we've done together, but, you know, credit spreads remain pretty tight, and they have been for a long time, particularly within high yield and some of the other lower quality asset classes. Do you think the market has become maybe too complacent here, given that spreads remain tight?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of risk priced into risk assets right now. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, when you look at where these spreads are for high yield to say at 320, if I look at a 25-year history, you're at the 10th, 15th percentile. Now, that doesn't mean that we think there's going to be a catalyst going forward, but a lot of people say, well, look at the yield that I'm earning. But, you know, given that spread, most of the yield that you're earning is actually coming from the treasury market. And because, you know, a lot of good news has been priced in, the equity market's done well, financial conditions have loosened, you know, you've seen a lot of spread compression within these risk assets. Now, as we always say, you know, spread widening doesn't impact your cash flows. Defaults impact your cash flows. Now, on the benefit to this risk, these risk assets compressing, is that you've had the capital markets that have been wide open. You've had all of this talk in the beginning of the year talking about, you know, maturities and what is due, and they've had the ability to go in and refi. I mean, you've taken out almost 35% of these maturities for, say, 24 and 25, and that helps future defaults lower, right? So it's not as though we're expecting some, you know, large rise in defaults. I mean, we're neutral to sector. You know, we just don't think that right now that, you know, you're not really compensated for, you know, that any type of hiccup that might happen going forward. And a lot of good news has been priced in terms of capital markets being open. Some of the indices are better quality. And also, I want to point out a lot of these dollar prices that we used to tout that, you know, I've got this discount dollar price that I, even if I hold to maturity, I'm going to accrete to par and take that return. If you look at where the 10-year is today versus, say, the high yield index, you know, the dollar price, you know, with the same 10-year, the dollar price today in high yield is higher because spreads have compressed. Right. So, again, it's not as though we think there's going to be a catalyst going forward. We just stayed neutral on them. We don't think it's a time to be complacent. But for where we are in the cycle, we just think it's much better off to take that higher quality and earn, you know, 5.5% to 6.5% and yield.
Great. Leslie, thanks. Just before we go on to our final question, but for audience questions, and I should have asked you this earlier. Right now, your target on the 10-year Treasury by year end is 3.85, correct?
Correct.
Okay, just wanted to confirm that. And CIO expects 2 rate cuts perhaps this year. I know we kind of got into that a little bit by the Fed, September, December. Obviously, everything will have to depend on what the data is for the next couple of cycles here. But just wanted to remind the audience of that.
Yes.
Great. Thanks, Leslie. All right, so let me this is the final question before we get to the audience questions. And we all know, David, I'll start with you, and I'm going to ask you and Leslie the same. 5 months before the presidential election here in the U.S., you know, it's anybody's guess at this point where we're going to go in a couple of weeks, months, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Debates are coming up soon. Then we have the convention. So what should investors expect through the summer really is the question. I mean, do we expect some volatility from this? Do we expect that it will be business as usual until we know? Does it even matter who's sitting in the White House? I mean, a lot of times you look at the history of the markets and it really doesn't. It depends on what's going on economically. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so before we get into this whole discussion, I think it's important to remind our listeners and viewers that a portfolio is not where you should express your political opinions, right? I mean, if you want to express a political opinion, the voting booth is a great place to do that.
Right.
Your portfolio is not a great place to do that. So I think it's important to just, you know, keep that in context. You know, that being said, yeah, I mean, look, it's probably going to be a tight race. And we know that investors generally don't like uncertainty, right? So there probably will be an increase in uncertainty as we go into the election because the markets aren't going to know precise or have a good sense necessarily about not only who's going to be in the White House, but what's going to be the complexion of Congress. And obviously that matters as well. I would say from a market perspective, I think the main questions that investors are contending with is, you know, some of the big picture questions are really going to be around tariffs, you know, especially if Trump gets back into office, that's certainly high on his agenda. You know, what's going to be the impact of that? You know, how much is just bluster and how in negotiation and how much is really going to be reality? Also, the expiration of the Trump tax cuts at the end of next year, that's obviously, you know, going to be a lot of discussion around what to do about that. And, you know, I would make a little bit of a contrast, though, between the last two presidential elections when I think the markets were very much focused on how much fiscal expansion are we going to get from the government. I think the question really here in going forward is going to be how much fiscal drag is there going to be, right? Because if we need to, right now deficits are very wide, and if the Trump tax cuts expire, then you're going to get deficit contraction. The question is, are we going to get all of that deficit contraction, or are they going to offset that in some way? So I think it's a very different setup than it was in the last prior two elections from a fiscal policy perspective, where, it's more about not about how much fiscal expansion, but how much fiscal drag are we going to get? So those are going to be, I think, the big questions that are going to be on people's minds. Obviously, there's going to be, you know, there's more specific things like healthcare policy, energy policy, which, you know, could affect specific companies. But from a market perspective, at a high level, those are the questions. And yes, I think we're not going to get a lot of clarity on that. Certainly on the outcome, very likely until we get, you know, past the election. And as a result, you know, we could see some volatility creep into the markets. But as you point out, you know, usually who's sitting in the White House and the makeup of Congress is not, it's not high on the list of what drives market returns.
Right. Thank you, David. Leslie, just anything more to add on that, particularly from where you're coming from when it comes to fixed income markets?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the market right now, if we look at, you know, the sort of forward volatility, you know, you see a kink in the curve, as you always do. around that October time period, but that's, you know, that's expected. You've done it historically. It's a little higher now versus history, and more, you know, it'll probably grow higher and higher and higher as you get to the election. But I think one of the things that David pointed out is at least on the interest rate side, it really depends on the sweep. I mean, if we look at normally, if there is a sweep, then things like 10s, 30s have a tendency to steepen, right? You know, three of the four past sweeps going back to 1980, the 10s, 30s, a month before and a month after the election, steepened out. The only time it didn't was during Obama because we were in a global financial crisis. And I think that's also the key as well. It really depends on what the economy is doing. And, you know, whether how strong the economy is, where we are in the economy, that's also going to, you know, dictate where interests are, not only just in terms of the level of rates, but also the shape of the curve.
Great, Leslie. Thanks. And by the way, for our audience, we're talking all about this. If you check out our UBS.com/ElectionWatch website, there's reports, there's videos on the, you know, effects or the impact potentially of the presidential election on individual sectors, et cetera. So check that out when you have some time. Okay, so let's get to some audience questions. Leslie, let me start with you because we got one in here asking about the yield curve inversion. Now, we know that the yield curve has been inverted for about 2 years. And if we see the Fed is going to start, you know, cutting rates and we see 10-year treasuries start to decline, will that allow the yield curve to normalize a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, we just passed, you know, history, actually, since I think we broke it since 1978, the amount of time the yield curve has been inverted. You know, my personal opinion, when it comes to recession, I believe the yield curve is a coincident, not a cause, but it's been a very long time. But with that said, you've also had a Fed on hold that's almost been a year. This July, it'll be a year that they've kept rates unchanged, which is also much longer than the norm. But as we know, we've had a lot of stimulus. So I do believe that the yield curve will normalize. You know, if I started this year, I had more of the thought process that it would normalize, go up a sloping by the end of this year. Now I'm probably going to push that to the first quarter, but I do think that it will normalize. And one of the reasons why as well is that, as we talked about before, the fixed income market is very forward-looking. So once the Fed cuts, and whether it's July, September, whatever it might be, from my perspective, really doesn't matter when. But when they cut, what happens is they take those forward cuts and they take those future cuts of 2025 and they pull them forward. So the short end starts to really go down. And we do think the curve will normalize, led by the short end declining, right? That's why we talk about people need to be concerned about, you know, their cash position and reinvestment risk. But it's been a long time. The Fed has been on hold for a long time. I do think, you know, the consumer is starting to face these headwinds in terms of credit card and auto rates. And it is our expectation that the curve will normalize. Me, if not by the end of the year, then by the first quarter.
Great, Leslie, thank you. Got another one in here for David. Just asking generally about energy markets, David. Anything to add on that as a sector where we're seeing oil prices go, and you know, even tied to potentially to who's sitting in the White House? You know, what could that do for energy markets here?
Yeah. So you know, the big news was we got an OPEC decision just in the last few days ago in terms of. They're outlining their plans to start bringing some of their production cuts back to the market. And we've seen oil prices fall as a result of that. I think there's probably been a little bit misinterpretation of what OPEC said in the marketplace, a misinterpretation by the market, that, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to do what they need to do to have a balanced market and to, you know, guide prices into the range that they would like to see. So, you know, given we think that we're going to see less supply growth this year, we do think it's appropriate that OPEC start to bring back some of these barrels. Now, if supply comes in higher than we think it does or higher than OPEC thinks it does, they won't bring back as many barrels, right? In other words, so they're still going to maintain this sort of balanced market. And, you know, from here, we think there's upside in oil prices into the for Brent, we have a price target in the next several months getting into low 90s. So, and then sort of high 80s by the end of the year. So we think there's some upside in oil prices. Now, in terms of the energy sector, we're neutral on it. You know, frankly, it's a pretty volatile sector. But I would say, you know, the risk reward is looking a little bit better after we've seen oil prices come down towards the lower end of the range, and energy equities have also recently underperformed.
Great. Thanks, David. One last question before we run out of time here today. Leslie, this one's for you. Asking about duration, obviously there's a lot of questions about that given where rates are, et cetera. So what duration in bonds would you go for right now, particularly, you know, in kind of high quality positioning? Where on the curve would you see the best opportunity?
Right. Well, first off, we extended our interest rate risk about a 4.67, but we keep our portfolio, and our recommended place on the curve is around that 5-year. And, you know, as we saw in this last rally in rates, the 5-year led the way. And the reason why the 5-year led the way is because the market is pricing in more cuts. So whenever the 5-year leads the way with in the curve with monetary policy, if the Fed is hawkish, yields go up more. When it's dovish, yields go down. Now, there's a few ways that you could have that 5-year. You know, we have in higher quality, like investment-grade corporates or munis, we have a barbell on, right? And you could have that barbell positioning in terms of trying to earn that carry because, as we discussed, Anthony, the curve is inverted, right? And have, you know, maybe like a 7 to 10 year to equal that 5, or you have various bullets like we have in, say, CMBS and MBS. But you want to have your portfolio toward that 5-year, but that doesn't mean you don't take advantage of like short end IG where you could earn very good carry given the curve is inverted.
Excellent. Leslie, thank you very much. And that takes us to just 30 minutes. So let me first thank you, Leslie Falconio, and also David Lefkowitz. Thanks for being here in the studio with me, David. And thank you all for joining us. Just as a quick heads up here, we are going to be skipping our next CIO Monthly because it falls on July 4th. That's the Thursday. So we'll be back again with another CIO Live on Thursday, August 1st. At 1 p.m. Eastern time. So just make sure you mark your calendars for that. Until then, we will continue to keep you updated with our latest views through our House View publications, our CIO alerts, and more. Plus, we have lots of great multimedia available, videos like this, our regular series, UBS Trending, and our new UBS Road to the Election series are all available for you, as well as podcasts and more featuring colleagues like David and Leslie from the Chief Investment Office. So make sure you check those out as well. And as always, we encourage you to continue this conversation with your UBS financial advisor. Until next time, again, August 1st. We'll see you in 2 months, everybody. Enjoy the first half of your summer and have a great 4th of July. And we'll see you in August. Have a great day.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.